the number of shareholders might become very limited in number. You might start out with 100 in a village, 50 sell out to the corporation, and you might have only maybe 50 people in the village controlling the corporation that owns all the land that those people may use. Human nature being what it is, the people controlling the corporation, the 50 who didn't sell out, might say, well, that land's ours, and the other 50 shouldn't be allowed to use it. That's just a thought that occurs to me, and perhaps you've considered it too. If you haven't, don't feel obliged to comment. But one of the troubles with angst is every time you think you've found a solution to something, it seems to raise more questions. But that resolution is one that deserves perhaps a little thought. Maybe there is no problem, but...
No, I think there's probably going to be a problem. It's probably just going to be with the corporations that are having the financial problems, like Bering Straits, because the shareholders are going to probably feel that there's nothing for them to hang on to, and they might want to sell it to try to get something out of it, and they don't feel that the region's going to turn around, and our region's just going to have to try to turn around and get the confidence back in order to and get the shareholders to be proud and show them a return on it so they can hang on it, because like any other corporation, if you don't make money, people usually sell the stock and unload it. And but things, I think, are going a little better now, but Bering Straits is just about out of money too, so they're going to have to turn around and gain some momentum here, and I think we have gained some momentum lately. But that does make a problem, because there's a lot of shareholders that are dissatisfied, and a lot of the older shareholders that feel that they may not be getting anything now. There's a few shareholders, some villages, that have instituted an insurance program where they're getting so much, $100 a month, something like that, and they're getting something. But some of the other villages, they may not get any. And our region is a poor example, probably, for are a good example of a region that has not done well at all. And I think things are starting to change around, but we're still not making money.
Well, thanks very much, Mr. O'Connor. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Lincoln Trigg, President of Arctic Native Brotherhood, Vice President of Sitsauk Native Corporation, President of Bureau of Indian Affairs Budget Advisory Committee. On behalf of the membership of the Arctic Native Brotherhood, I would like to welcome to Nome and the Bering Straits region. It is appreciated that the elders and members who cannot travel out of the region had a chance to testify. We appreciate ASCA, but we know that there are changes that have to be made regarding our land stock alienation after Borns. I hope our people will give adequate testimony in this regards. Again, welcome to Bering Straits region. Kleana.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Somebody asked me where you were going after lunch, and I said I'm going down for another burger. Well, anyway,
that's burger.
Yeah, I know. And What I'd like to discuss briefly are three things: education, social impact, and what was the other one? I don't write too much. Well, anyway, I'm Guy Martin. I'm representing myself. Just to justify where I'm coming from, in 1963, which is 24 years ago, I was a policeman in the state of Alaska, here in Nome, Alaska, and went away after that and came back after I became a native again. Well, anyway, education, just on the brighter side, and maybe I could speak a little bit on the other side, what the land claims have done to us as a peoples, divide us, and also put pressures upon us that we weren't able to handle. We're learning now, but we're still in the learning process. This has cost us dearly. Well, enough about that, but getting back to education. One of the biggest days in my life was last year, last winter, when the fifth grade class combined up at the Nome Elementary School invited me over to talk about land claims. And as a reward, about a week later, I got a letter signed by all the fifth grade students. This was a unique period because all the children except for one that was left behind in school were the same age as the Land Claim Settlement Act in that 6 month, 8 month period. And I could relate to them by name because I knew their parents. I don't see much more of this. I know there have been factions within the education process here in Alaska to include our younger people to the Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971. I think they're working on it, and we just don't hear about it as much as we should. And I'd like to pat the people on the back, or educators that are doing this. Getting on to the other impact, it's kind of emotional that we're lumping social impacts with the land claims, but I feel in this case they go hand in hand. You speak of subsistence, you speak of constriction of land, circumvention. These are all true to an extent because of an act. When you take away a person's hunting privileges and constrict the land that he's to hunt on, and also tell him when to hunt and how to hunt specifically, then you're forcing the man to become greedy, or the woman that gathers birds. Not all, only men hunt in this country. You force the people to become greedy. I speak from experience in this because of my past relationship with a five-region board of another resource management scheme from Barrel down to Togiak. I'm not going to mention it here, but one of the reasons that we asked for federal oversight after we became a state, long after we became a state, was that the state laws were becoming inadequate to our people to live with. However, the act came along in 1971 and further constricted our hunting and fishing privileges. I'm saying all this to build up a point. It's still social point. It's still a social point. And this further constricted us. We got a little back, as you said yesterday, we were listening to you on the radio, as you said yesterday, through amendments in D2, if you will, or as we call it in the villages, Jimmy Carter Act, and through ANILCA specifically, gave us back some of our privileges for hunting and fishing. However, this didn't correct the whole problem. The point I'm getting at now is that when you take away a group of people's mainstay, which is subsistence, and by subsistence I mean gathering of food, making of handicrafts, women sew, men carve or women carve, men sew, I don't care. This is a fact up here. If we were carpenters, we'd be carpenters, but we're not carpenters. So when you take away their pride and their will to hunt, if you will, their will to gather their food in their traditional ways, this builds up. This can turn to alcohol. This can turn to drug abuse, a multitude of other anti-social actions brought onto communities within our region. This in turn breeds dropouts in school, which in turn breeds crime and lackadaisiness. The point I'm bringing across is that through these constrictive acts, in particular the 1971 Native Claims Settlement Act, without its amendments, without the amendments that our leaders are trying to overcome and make it more palatable, so to speak, for our people, without these hopes that we can take to Congress, we're still stuck in the mud. And I didn't want to be too pessimistic about this, but these are the hard facts. Every society has drinkers. Every society has criminals. However, if you give dignity as well as regulation, if you give regulation with dignity, you will have a better outcome. Most of the things that you've been hearing throughout your state visits in our villages, which we're grateful for, have been negativisms. And they're there. They're not going to go away. We also have tools to correct that, but we don't know how far we can go. For instance, stock alienation and afterborns. And not stepping out of my line as Cy Citizen or Guy Martin, just citizen. Everywhere I've been, and I travel a lot on official business, that is brought up at the coffee clutches, at the end of the night's meetings, at bingo or something, in the different villages. They're worried about their children that did not make that 1971 deadline. And there are, at the village corporation levels, maybe because of our system, one person in one village might know about it, and he's dealing with the regional corporation. The regional corporation is dealing with AFN. However, because of the nature of our livelihood, we don't go to all the meetings. And maybe we should start to go to any little meeting that we have in our villages, whether it be IRA, Village Native Corporation, City Council, and then get involved. There's a saying when I was down at Holy Cross and I was 6 months old, I moved down there from Nome. And I've lost most of that language being born up here. I only knew Athabascan. They said to, forgive my butcher job, but outgovyuk the Govensky. That means outfox the fox. If we're going to live under white man law, you know, let's do it better than them. And the only way we can do it better than them is use their own tools, the political process. But I just wanted to share with you some of the real problems that are on the street and in the homes. And they stem from acts that are just not, they're impalatable, Judge. And we'd like to correct those things. And if we can't see light at the end of the tunnel, then we'll have to do the next best. But stock alienation and protection, or giving stock, not stock, shares to our afterborns is paramount. It's important. So, like I said before, we've had a lot of bad publicity. The Native people of Alaska, they take pictures of us down on 4th Avenue in Anchorage. If they catch one down in Seattle, they'll take a picture there. There's an Alaskan Native. He's drunk. See him laying down. Well, every society has that, being repetitive. However, if you take away their pride and take away their mainstay, their lifestyle, then you're building problems within the family structures, the schools, and society in general. Not to be end up on a pessimistic note, once we learn something, we tend to do it better than anyone else. And that's the only note of optimism I have. If, years from now, they'll say, well, aren't you from Alaska? Maybe 100 years from now, and they'll say, well, geez, we need you, your legal help on this, and we need your financial support on that, hopefully, and we need your wildlife resource management training on that. And they said, well, how did you go to school for that? And they said, no. They passed the act in 1971. That's years ago. And they made us experts. So thank you for listening to this.
Thank you. Yeah.
Welcome to Nome, Judge Berger. My name is Clinton Gray, and I'm with Coeric, one of the ANCSA nonprofit corporations. And I grew up in Nome, and I'm just giving a testimony today as an individual citizen. I think both Guy Martin and myself epitomize the impact that ANCSA has had, because we both gained about 50 pounds in the last 9 years. One of the things I think is important to remember when discussing ANCSA and is the historical perspective and how things were, say, in the 40s and 50s and early 60s. And going on to that, I'd like to complete through my personal view of ANCSA and then see how you can make it prescriptive for other societies throughout the world where indigenous people are impacted by an encroaching Western industrial civilization. In 1940, the natives who resided in Nome, by and large, or any so-called white community, were victimized by prejudice and lack of opportunity. It was brought on, I think, by the educational system that had been in place for decades earlier, in which the native people were subjected to having their religion discarded for mainly the Christian religions, and their language discarded to become English-speaking. And they're impacted by people coming up for the resources such as whaling and gold mining and other exploitative industry. And I talk mainly from this area, but I think that pattern happened throughout Alaska. And in the 40s, it was hard for even the women, for instance, could not get a job as a waitress because of the stigma of TB, tuberculosis, which had been brought in by the outside. And many other diseases were brought in, and the Public Health Service was one of the major federal government agencies to impact the Alaska Native in this area, mainly to eradicate tuberculosis, but also to provide for the health and welfare of the Alaska Native. The in the 50s, many of our people, the brightest Alaska Native people, were sent out by the Bureau of Indian Affairs for training. And by and large, they were relocated out of the area. So those who could best serve their people were unable to come back and relocated in the lower 48. Then in the early 60s, under the Kennedy administration and the Johnson administration, the War on Poverty was launched. And it awakened in many Native people the feeling that we had to reduce the sectionalism that was rampant. Natives from Southeast, the interior, the West, and the North were disjointed, and we weren't a united voice in the face of the ever-increasing white movement into the Alaskan scene. And I'm not denigrating the white movement. I'm half Eskimo myself, and my grandfather was a white man. But the Native people as a whole were in a very tenuous position in the urban areas because they were unable to gain jobs in any large numbers. They were second-class citizens in their own country, in their own land. And a few men, my uncle included, Nick Gray, formed the Cook Inlet Native Association in 64, the Fairbanks Native Association, and the Kuskokwim Valley Native Association in the Bethel area. And these associations and amalgamations were to provide some united, cohesive voice for the people. And this was to better the lot of the Alaska Native in Alaska. And we were fully at the whim of the bureaucracy of the BLM, the BIA, and the IHS. But these people were dedicated. They worked with low pay and no status, but especially in the Indian Health Service, to better the health and welfare in the face of minimal appropriations from Congress to do their job. So the natives unified in those early days. They didn't have any money. My uncle would hitchhike from Spinard downtown to go on TV, and he said he enjoyed it because he could discuss the issues with people who brought him downtown also. But he died in 1966, and after that, the younger leaders came forward to carry on this impetus for some organized central Alaskan Native organization to do what had to be done. And my uncle stated that Secretary Udall was using his own brain trust and not consulting with the Native people in formulating the land claim settlement. He said, "This must not happen. We have to organize and resist these kind of moves." And the associations and brotherhoods throughout Alaska, made up of Alaska Natives, finally coalesced, and ANCSA was realized. The questions that remain in our state today among the Native community, one of which is, was ANCSA engineered by Washington? Is there a hidden agenda to take over the land of our people? And these are real questions we have to begin analyzing and thinking about. ANCSA created 12 regions. It divided us once again. It made sections into our state. Where the early natives were fighting against this sectionalism, it came in again. We have 12 regions, and we have profit arm and non-profit arm in each of those 12 regions. The profit arms, and I guess you'd say the nonprofit arms, benefit really only five classes that I'm able to surmise. I see the groups as lawyers, accountants, business consultants, natives like myself who are lucky enough to have employment in those corporations. And finally, the unknown, those companies or individuals who will gain from an ultimate hold on the land. The ANCSA has really separated our people. The profit arms are there for only two purposes, to maximize profit and minimize loss. And they seem inappropriate to be protectors of the land or the cultural heritage if there is to be some resurgence there. I think that has to be rethought. And any other groups in the world that are thinking of this vehicle as a vehicle for land claims, transfer, and benefit should really analyze whether corporations are the vehicle to be used. Another item that I've noticed, I went to council, which is about 70 miles from Nome. There, my grandfather settled in the early 1900s and married a native woman, and my dad was born there, raised there. And I went down there last week, and in the very land that my forefathers resided in, it now seems that I cannot even reside there myself by dint of belonging to another village corporation. The BLM, the federal government, and the state government, and the village corporations are the landholders, but I think this ANCSA has taken away the freedom of movement of individual native people in their own land and the nomadic existence that afforded them the ability to live in this land. I think that is a real strong item that must be looked at. And the ANCSA was implemented so quickly, and there was no concurrent training or centralized placement agency within the state of a centralized nature so that we could begin to hire our people into the few jobs that the corporations did provide. And there was no vehicle for Alaskan Native industry and businesses to form to begin to contract with their own corporations. There was very much training lacking and very much limited opportunity for Alaskan Natives. The education training was not there, and it continues today to be not there, although we're making advances all along the line, and individual Natives are accomplishing educational objectives, which I believe they would have done even if there was not ANCSA. But ANCSA has also provided a large number of employment opportunities in the regions. When I graduated from high school here in Nome 20 years ago, almost every young high school graduate had to leave Nome or this area if they were to find employment. There absolutely was limited employment. That picture has changed drastically as a result of ANCSA, and I believe that's one of the better functions of the ANCSA Act was the provision of employment throughout the state.
You graduated from high school in the 60s.
64. Uh-huh. Overall, I think ANCSA has led to a higher quality of life for the Native people or those aspiring to their educational and career goals within their own region and their ability to live in that region and enjoy the best of both worlds now. I've heard a lot of comments that people make to me that, you know, they have a job and they can also subsist and enjoy that life way. But in my mind, you cannot live in both worlds forever. That will change in the future. I don't know how far down the line that will change. But the Native community had always been a communal community, shared existence. And the Western style of life is for individual action and individual scope of work. So the cultures cannot mix. You cannot have a Native culture on the one hand and a Western type of life on the other. They do not mix. And when I belong to a generation who were veterans in the Vietnam era and had to go out to school also for college training. And when ANCSA passed in 71, a large number of us were unable to provide any kind of input or be of assistance in any capacity because we were fighting a war and gaining a college education. And we came back, and many corporations and even some regional corporations had already squandered their wealth, and we were left with having to pick up the pieces in certain cases. And now there's many of us back, and more of our youth are becoming educated in universities. I think there's still racism, paternalism in certain people in Alaska, a small minority, but it is evident everywhere. The Alaska Native people in our area have no control over any media. The only statewide media we have is the Tundra Times. And no people, no culture can survive or hold their own without any means of communicating and understanding of their culture. And that is one thing that is lacking in many of our northern and western Alaska areas. We have no radio and no newspapers. But there are good people, both Native and non-Native, who banded together in the 60s and who continue today to work together to hold what we have and to try to come to some understanding and resolution of the problems that are facing us in 1991. One thing, our Alaska Native people have always been very adaptable. We are an intelligent race, and I have good feelings for the future. Our youth are asking a lot of questions, and they're going to be a valuable resource for us in the future. And I think the early leaders who were there in the 50s and 60s before all the money came, who struggled for their people, would find that today the world has changed for the Alaska Native. And I think for the better. There are still many problems existing and some I foresee in the future, but I think by and large our people are beginning to stand up, to enter the political arena, and to make change. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gray.
Thanks very much.
Good afternoon. My name is Vern Kozrak. I'm representing myself.
and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before your committee. I would like to speak on one issue that I have been involved in for quite a number of years. And I think I can honestly say that I grew up with the industry in which I'm about to speak of and for. And because that industry has been specifically named in all the major land laws in Alaska, it was named in the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, ANILCA laws, and the only industry of its kind in the United States, and one of two in the North American countries. I'm speaking of the reindeer industry. I think, in my opinion, is that the reindeer industry is the only agricultural industry within Alaska that has become the victim of one of the first, in the way of impact on the industry, because of these certain laws being passed. While these laws are good for the people, in most cases, they're hard to understand. And there are a number of reindeer herders, I think, have the same feeling that I have. As I have seen the Alaska Native Claims Act progress up to this day, is that the because of this, there was the offshoots like the oil developments in certain areas, offshore developments. And noting too that the most of the coastal villages and their population is dependent on sea mammals, and this has been their food for many, many years. Now, I think what is important is that many are wondering now if because of developments, like for instance the sea mammals is hurt by an oil spill or something, is the reindeer industry ready to give alternative food source? I think much of the development there would not have been any of these types of developments so quickly had it not been for the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And I think the reindeer industry deserves a seat somewhere in the way of having something to say in how the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is going to be affecting the people all throughout the state. I think the industry certainly has its potential, and it can become one of the most viable and stable meat sources for not only this region, but throughout the other regions as well, and perhaps throughout the state. I gave you this little background to come to the real issue of the whole problem here. I think this issue is important enough to keep in mind that one of the biggest things that has to be solved is the land problem. Because of the Alaska Native Settlement Act, there had become many estate owners. There are many village corporation owners, regional corporation owners. State now owns a lot of land. And of course, BLM has always been owners here and there. And the United States Fish and Wildlife owns land. And I think because of these many land problems facing the reindeer industry, it is something that has to be solved within the next 5 or 6 years before a stable economy can be established in the way of reindeer industry within the, not only in this region, but I feel throughout the state. While most of the reindeer herders have some type of an agreement between the village and the regional corporations, and some with the state and BLM, but that is not to say that all land problems have been solved. There's much work to be done, and without the land, solving the land problems, the reindeer industry will continue to suffer in one way, shape, or form. We understand, or the reindeer industry understand too, that certainly for using somebody's land, you have to have some type of an agreement or permission to use that portion of the land for whatever reason, and in this case, grazing. And please let us not forget, according to the Alaska Native Settlement Act, it specifically states that reindeer grazing will continue. But in what shape or form? I think that is something that needs to be studied extensively, and perhaps with the help from other agencies and with the local resource agency people, I think something can be done perhaps before 1991. I think the reindeer industry also understands that 1991 and beyond is probably some of the most important times between the date of 1971 through 1991. I think one other thing that most of the herders have been involved in is that they have come into a situation where before the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act, you had your allotment and you paid $10 per year for that one allotment. It might be 1 million acres or 595,000 acres or something for in which for the ranger to graze. But he was paying only to one agency. Now, in some cases, one herd owner will have to deal with maybe 4 or 5 estate owners on one grazing allotment. And this is something perhaps through some type of a cooperative agreement between all the estate owners, maybe something can develop in the way of making it easier and not become a hardship for the only industry to survive in the region. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.